Now we're taking a look at the leak of hundreds of what appear to be classified Defense Department documents. Those documents deal with the war in Ukraine, U.S. intelligence on Russia and on American allies, and more. They were leaked over the course of several months on Discord, a social media platform popular with gamers. The FBI today arrested an Air Force National Guard member suspected of leaking the documents. According to sources in the Washington Post and New York Times, the documents were leaked to impress teen members of an online group devoted to guns, video games, and racist memes. There's still a lot of details that are still unclear. We're going to focus on what those leaked documents tell us about the war in Ukraine and the U.S. response and the impact that information could have now that it's public. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts, your reactions to this leak of what appear to be a bunch of classified documents? How do you think this could affect U.S. relationships with allies? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ted Gerber is a professor of sociology at UW-Madison and director of the Wisconsin-Russia Project. He's an expert on Russia and post-Soviet states. Ted, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We're going to be hearing about this investigation into the leaks themselves for a while. I want to focus on the impact they have as you're watching this information emerge. What strikes you as most significant, especially as this information relates to the war going on in Ukraine right now?
Well, it's a good question. There are lots of tidbits that are of interest to those of us who've been following the war closely. But I would say there hasn't been anything that's come out yet, at least, that I think has been hugely surprising or that represents kind of a dramatic new piece of information. So it is certainly troubling to hear that the, you know, for example, that the U.S. government assesses that the war is likely to continue as it has been throughout the remainder of this year. Although, you know, again, it's not terribly surprising.
Right.
I think a lot of the expert community probably feels the same way. It's also, the extent to which the Ukrainian forces were facing severe or perhaps probably do continue to face severe shortages of certain types of munitions, problems in their air defenses. Those are very troubling to hear. But again, you know, not exactly shocking news.
Right. We see some information related to, the disposition of Ukrainian troops, the armaments, some of the places they are. But apparently, from what's been released so far, not things like, you know, specific plans about the goals of an expected Ukrainian offensive this spring. So from an intelligence perspective, in some ways, it could be worse.
That's right. I think it could be worse. I mean, you know, I would actually agree. I think President Biden, when he said that the most troubling aspect of the leak so far is the leak itself, and I think that's very true. That's not to say that, you know, we shouldn't be concerned about this, because if these documents got out, I mean, it's certainly possible that more significant documents will get out, or perhaps already are out there and just haven't been posted yet. And so I would say that so far, you know, the leak is embarrassing. There's information in there that makes it very awkward for U.S. officials and their dealings with our allies. It does raise issues of potential trustworthiness of U.S. government, statements and so forth. But there's nothing that is deeply upsetting yet. But, you know, the fact that within the Defense Department, these kinds of documents are available to individuals such as the, you know, alleged perpetrator, Mr. Teixeira, a 21-year-old gamer, you know, who was part of the Air National Guard. I mean, it's very troubling, and, you know, it does raise serious concerns about potential future leaks.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mac is with us in Madison. Mac, hello.
Hey, my question is, how did somebody at this, what appears to be a low-level position, have such access? And it kind of reminds me of the Snowden case. I can't recall how he got access. Is this a simple case of hacking a computer that he might have somehow gained access to?
Mac, thanks for the call. This is a question I assume we don't know the answer to at this point, Ted. It's a question I'm assuming the military and intelligence and members of Congress are already asking about this. One thing I want to focus on with you is something that you said. That's a question U.S. allies are going to be asking. I mean, this is, I don't have quite the right words for it. This is the stupidest reason for a major leak of intelligence information I've ever heard of. How much do you worry that U.S. allies are going to look at the U.S. and say, "Yeah, I don't think I want to cooperate. I'm an intelligence agency in Europe. Do I really want to share information with the U.S. if this can happen?"
Well, yes, exactly. That is a concern, and it's a perpetual concern. I mean, your caller just referred to the Snowden case. There have been other leaks before that. So on the one hand, yes, I mean, this gets a lot of media attention, and it certainly is not helpful. And it's certainly, you know, if I were a foreign intelligence organization official or a government official, it certainly would increase my level of concern. But in the real world, these people who are in those positions, they're fully aware of the risks that something like this could happen. It has happened before. And so I think, you know, that it's more like the PR side of things is the most dramatic aspect of the story, at least so far. I want to qualify, at least in terms of what's come out so far. And so I would reiterate that. I mean, you know, in terms of your listener's question, I mean, as you pointed out, we don't know. We'll find out. But I mean, the Department of Defense and the U.S. intelligence operations are vast, and they rely on a lot of different employees, a lot of different workers, and who are located in different places. And, you know, it's always a challenge that a major intelligence organization or collection of organizations, which is what the U.S. intelligence and other governments' intelligence are, when they have to coordinate a lot of different levels of access, a lot of different employees. And so, you know, although it's certainly not good news that these leaks happen, and I do hope that the officials in our government will get to the bottom of what's going on, will take action to prevent this from happening. I think it's also fair to say that this is not a rare event. It happens in other countries. It happens anytime we have classified documents. And it also, to me, points to the role of the information age that we live in, with the rise of information technologies, the extreme sophistication of different users, private users, government agencies, and so forth, which sort of has a magnifying effect on, or potential magnifying effect anyway, on these leaks when they do occur.
Talking to Ted Gerber from UW-Madison, expert on Russia and post-Soviet states, looking at this leak of classified information, much of it, a lot of it related to Ukraine and Russia. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. Art is with us in Milwaukee. Art, hi.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. So they often say that the first casualty in war is the truth. And I looked at the Washington Post summary of this, and indicates two points I got out of it. One, that the internal assessment is that this is a stalemate and there's no one likely to really win this war decisively in the next year or maybe a couple of years. And secondly, that our State Department is not interested in pursuing negotiations, but basically, as some people say, to fight to the last Ukrainian to combat Russia. And so I think it's sobering when we're asked to send these billions, and the Ukrainians and Russians are both dying in huge numbers, that we get a little bit of the inside story. So thank you.
Art, thanks for the call. Art, I think pointing toward the idea, Ted, that maybe we should be shifting our strategy toward encouraging negotiations between Ukraine and Russia. What might that look like?
Well, that really is indeed the crux of the dilemma that the U.S. government faces. And so the U.S. policy up to this point has been that it's really up to the Ukrainians themselves to decide if and when it is time to negotiate. The Ukrainians have been quite consistent in insisting that the conditions are not met and that Putin is an unreliable partner to negotiate anyway. And, now while it is true that the U.S. could decide to sort of up the pressure, so that's what those who call for negotiations are saying, that the U.S. should basically compel the Ukrainians to go to the negotiating table by saying that the U.S. will withdraw its support and the support of its allies. I mean, let's face it, there really is a coordinated effort at which the United States is at the forefront. And that, therefore, you know, that's how the U.S. could do it. And, first of all, the assessment is an assessment that came out in the leaks, and the assessments have been wrong before. And so, Although, and there's also competing assessments. So within the government, within the various intelligence agencies, different analysts prepare different assessments, and they don't always concur. So there could be other assessments within the government that are different, within the U.S. government, that is. But you also have to keep in mind what the stakes are. And so although it does sound the way that actually Putin put it in his speech and that others have put it, that the U.S. is deciding to fight to the last Ukrainian, it ultimately, in my view, it really is the Ukrainians, because they are bearing the brunt of the casualties and the loss in terms of their both their lives, but also their economy. If they decide they want to go to the negotiating table, which would involve certainly making concessions to Russia of their territory, then the U.S. is not going to stand in their way. But it doesn't seem like it's really the U.S.'s place to compel them to do so. I think the risks of negotiating at this point anyway outweigh the potential benefits of doing so.
All right. Thanks for the call. I want to talk about that a little more, Ted. As of right now, it appears that Putin would not accept a negotiation without getting some chunks of Ukrainian territory. We see what happens when Russia occupies territory, large-scale murder and war crimes, abduction of children, and the notion that Putin would say, okay, I've got this land and I'm going to stop now. It seems like there's a lot of disincentives for the Ukrainians to embrace that idea of, yeah, we'll give up some of our territory.
I absolutely agree 100%. I think that is the crucial point that those who call for negotiation seem to miss or prefer not to have at the forefront of the discussion. And that is that there really isn't any means to negotiate with a power such as ISS Russia be today, which is really hell-bent on taking over all of Ukraine, on subordinating Ukraine to Russia, on imposing Russian policies, Russian government on Ukraine, and on basically destroying and eliminating Ukrainians as a nation. And I think I'm not exaggerating when I think that is the Russian policy, and any negotiation would only temporarily stave off that policy. So long as Putin is in power, and perhaps it's not just Putin, I really do actually do think it's mainly Putin, but so long as he is in power, Ukraine will never be safe from the threat of a basically genocidal attack on the part of the Russian state. So one can advocate negotiations, but I think the only way I would support that idea is if negotiations are intended or understood to be coming up with a strategy to buy time so that Russia could be fully defeated in its effort to take over Ukraine. I don't really see that it's up to the United States or Ukraine when this war ends. It's up to Russia. Unless Russia is able to win, the war is going to end when Russia is beaten badly enough that the Russian government has no choice but to cease its operations and withdraw. And I don't think negotiation is going to lead to that. I think you're absolutely right that if negotiation under the current context would require major concessions and all those factors that you discussed, the deportation of children, the extreme Russification policies, those would certainly prevail. And Ukraine would remain under danger, whatever is left of Ukraine after the negotiation settlement.
We're talking about the leak of Defense Department documents, including information related to the war in Ukraine. Ted Gerber is with us, professor of sociology at UW-Madison, expert on Russia and post-Soviet states. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions, your questions, your thoughts on what all this means for Russia and Ukraine and the U.S. role there. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Ted Gerber, professor of sociology at UW-Madison, an expert on Russia and post-Soviet states, talking about the leak of classified Defense Department documents, including info related to the war in Ukraine, what we're learning about that war in these documents. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Jed is with us in Le Coup d'Orée. Jed, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Jed?
I'm not going to regurgitate the same old talking points. I'm going to very simply and briefly tell you some new ones. Peace now. End all wars. And before he cut me off, there's no winners to war. So it's not a, it's a zero sum here.
And gotcha, Jed. Thanks for the call. Ted, I don't know. Easier said than done with an occupying army sitting in a country?
Well, yes. I mean, I certainly, and I'm sure, you know, many listeners share that sentiment that everybody, there's nobody, or I wouldn't say nobody, there are very few people who actually want war, who actually see this as a great opportunity to achieve something. But I have to remind you that, you know, Ukraine did not start this war. The United States did not start this war. And I say that even, you know, now the United States maybe could have had different policies towards Russia. That's arguable, but it's certainly, you know, I certainly reject the idea that anybody started this war except for Russia. So the issue of peace now, that is an issue for Russia to be addressed to Russia. It's Russia who has attacked a sovereign country, and not just attacked, but attacked extremely brutally with major force, including attacks, you know, systematic attacks on civilian populations. So, you know, it's quite easy to say peace now. Yes, we want peace. Everybody wants peace, but it's not the United States that is responsible for this war. I mean, unless you advocate that Ukraine should just fold over and let the Russians take over their country and basically exterminate them as a people. I mean, I don't think that that is something that the U.S. should do or that its allies should do. So I do think it is a good slogan, peace now. It is certainly something everybody hopes for. And I certainly don't think that, you know, there's kinds of pro-military, pro-war, rah-rah patriotism that's driving the U.S. effort to support the Ukrainians in their effort, in, you know, their efforts to stay free from Russian occupation. But that, to me, I'm troubled when I hear that kind of slogan, because it does seem a little bit simplistic and naive, and it fails to place the blame for this war where it squarely belongs, which is on Mr. Putin and on his government and forces.
I want to look inside Russia now, Ted, and some of the documents involved in this leak. Talk about divisions within the Russian government and military between the head of the Wagner group of mercenaries, the official army, the National Guard, intelligence services. Again, not a surprise. We knew some of this was going on. Did you see anything in this leaks that amplified some of those tensions?
Well, I will say, and so the conflict between Prigozhin, who, you know, directs the Wagner group, and the official Russian services, that's been well known and well documented. The leaked documents maybe gave some nuance. I was, but one thing that I was a little bit more surprised by was the information about the documents show that there was a dispute or some contretemps between the intelligence services, the FSB, which is the successor to the KGB specifically, and then the armed forces, the Russian, you know, equivalent of the Department of Defense, the military, over reports on casualty numbers. And so that was something that I was again, it's not surprising, but it is interesting to hear, because that's gotten a lot less play in the Western media coverage and the sort of think tanks and the Twitter observers who comment extensively on the war. And so it does, you know, it does appear that, you know, if anything, so we knew that there was conflict within the Russian sort of military elite, and one would expect such conflicts in the case of a war. Mm-hmm. And the leaked documents do confirm, if anything, maybe the conflict is even more extensive and more complex than we had previously known. So certainly, and that's, of course, from the perspective of, you know, an adversary of this war machine that Ukraine is facing, it's good news when you hear that the adversary has these kinds of conflicts and struggles. Now, whether or not that means that Russia is on the imminent brink of an internal coup or something like that is, of course, a much more questionable conclusion to reach. But it certainly is not good for the Russian war effort that they're having these kinds of disagreements and disputes and outright confrontations. I mean, Prigozhin, now there's signs that he's trying to take over a political party. And so that is consistent with the reports that he may actually be aiming to be Mr. Putin's successor himself, which, of course, may or may not actually work. It's unlikely to actually work, but it certainly is another potential source of these kinds of conflicts and cleavages on the Russian side of really breaking out into the open and causing some kind of severe crisis within the Russian military establishment.
Time for one more caller. Austin is with us in Westby. Austin, hi.
Hi there. I had read a book several years ago called Vodka Politics, that kind of documents the way that alcohol has been used as a mechanism for statecraft in Russia and the Soviet Union. And wondering if that's what the gentleman thinks are mechanisms that are being used to quell opposition to the war as of current.
Interesting question, Austin, Ted, in just our last minute, internal dissent in Russia, to the extent that it's there, how is it managed by the regime?
Well, I would say that vodka policy may have something to do with it, but it's really a third order or minor element. That the Russian government has really reached dramatic new heights beyond even what some of us who've been very skeptical and cynical about, or very critical of the Russian government's crackdown on its civil society and on civic freedoms in Russia, have expected. And so I would just note that, that Russia has become an all out and out full-fledged authoritarian country since the start of the war. It was moving well in that direction for the last decade or so. People are probably familiar with some of the relevant laws, such as the foreign agent law, the undesirable organizations law, but we've really seen an incredible extent of a crackdown on free speech. We cases and cases of people who are being not just prosecuted, but arrested, or not just arrested, but prosecuted and sent in jail for long sentences for posting very innocuous things on Facebook. Even their children in school sometimes are drawing a drawing saying, "I support peace," and it's arresting the parents, getting put in jail. This is an outright authoritarian crackdown. Journalists have fled the country. All independent news outlets have been shut down, and most of their employees have actually fled Russia. We see an unprecedented, ever since the Soviet Union, unprecedented extent of a full-fledged coercive attack. And, universities are losing faculty. They're in danger of shutting down. It's really, really extreme.
We'll have to leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Ted Gerber, professor of sociology at UW-Madison. Talk to us about the leak of classified U.S. intelligence documents, including some related to the war in Ukraine.